Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian Laveau. In May 1787, those we commonly refer to as our founding fathers gathered in Philadelphia to create a new frame of government, a new American Constitution. Some have referred to it as a coup d'etat, some as a brilliant solution. But what were they overthrowing, and what was the problem they were trying to solve? Talking History's Fred Nielsen takes up these and other related questions this week with his guest, Carol Birkin. Following that, Fiona Beatty will offer us another Versites of the Week, this one, quite appropriately, on the U.S. Constitution. And Tracy Campbell will conclude the show by looking at election irregularities, or outright fraud, in American history. But first, we report on some troubling items of historical interest in the news you may have missed. A study recently issued by the British Museum reports that U.S.-led troops using the ancient Iraqi city of Babylon as a base have damaged and contaminated artifacts dating back thousands of years in one of the most important archaeological sites in the world. Military vehicles crushed a 2,600-year-old brick pavement, the study notes, and archaeological fragments, including broken bricks stamped by King Nebuchadnezzar II, were scattered across the site. The dragons at the Ishtar Gate were marred by cracks and gaps where someone tried to remove their decorative bricks, and large quantities of sand mixed with ancient fragments have been taken from the site to fill military sandbags. The archaeological site of Babylon, which is 50 miles south of Baghdad, has been occupied by U.S. Marines since the early days of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. In a related article in the news, reports on damage done to Iraq's oldest library, the House of Books and Documents, located in Baghdad. This national library held works of Arab literature, a vast archive of Ottoman-era grandeur, the papers of the British-sponsored monarchy, and the records of the past 30 years of Ba'ath Party rule. Most of the collection was lost in a fire in the library that broke out during the U.S. military invasion of that city. Some believe the fire was set intentionally to destroy Ba'ath Party records, but much else, perhaps 60% of the entire archive, was lost in the process. Some of the rarest books in the collection were moved out of the library before the fire and hidden in a nearby government tourist office, but when the office was reopened, the books were found floating in water because a water pipe had burst. Some of the rarest items have turned up in street markets. Others are yet to be found. This is Talking History. It was a long, hot summer in Philadelphia for the Founding Fathers, and it wasn't just the weather. They were responding to a crisis that threatened the very life of the new nation. What resulted, our guest this week concludes, was a brilliant solution. Talking History's Fred Nielsen speaks with Carol Birkin.
A summer-long political debate might seem an unlikely source of drama, but in 1787, for the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, the stakes could not have been higher. As my guest Carol Birkin has written, a sense of crisis led the Founding Fathers to Philadelphia, where they gathered behind locked doors and bolted windows to overthrow the legitimate government of the United States. By writing the Constitution, they staged what she calls a bloodless coup d'etat. Carol Birkin is a professor of history at Baruch College and the City University of New York, and the author of A Brilliant Solution, Inventing the American Constitution. Professor Birkin, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your book about the Constitution is entitled A Brilliant Solution. What were the problems that needed to be solved in 1787?
They're multiple. I think one way to look at this is that the Articles of Confederation were a wonderful fulfillment of some of the principles of revolution. The problem is what one needs to do when you're running a nation sometimes turns out to be very different from what you're doing when you protest and make a revolution. The Articles fulfilled the idea that you avoided tyranny and you avoided abuse of power by making sure that the government was terribly restrained and constrained, that it lacked certain powers. And I think more than anything, the Articles of Confederation were designed by states that saw their own local assemblies as the source of sovereignty and power. No taxation without representation really was a reference to their own local colonial governments. And so they design a constitution the first time around that fits these principles. Then they wake up the morning after and they discover that this doesn't work when you're involved in diplomacy, trade, finance, and politics as an independent nation. And so the problems that they faced were how, I think, to make a transition to a government that would make a viable nation in the world of nations instead of a government that symbolized the values of the revolution. Very specifically, the country was in deep, terrible debt, and the central government had no power to tax. The states each set their own commerce rules and were setting tariffs against one another that pretty seriously hindered interstate trade, brought it to a standstill. Different money for each state. It was like trying to travel through Europe in the old days before the euro, where you had to change money at every border. And I think, seriously, the men who went to the convention in Philadelphia believed the country was on the verge of collapse. I don't think that's an exaggeration. If you read their letters, if you read what they have to say to one another, they genuinely believed that the nation was about to vanish.
You call what they do a coup d'etat, which suggests that someone or something is being overthrown. How'd they get away with that?
Well, that was a bit of literary drama. It is a coup d'etat in the sense that they were only in power to recommend amendments to the Articles of Confederation. The Confederation Congress allowed them to meet, and the assumption was they would send recommendations for how to strengthen the government. One of the first things they do, in essence, is say, we're throwing out that constitution, we're writing a new one. That is, in effect, a coup d'etat. But they got away with it because when they were done, unlike in the history of many other countries, they didn't enforce the constitution by raising an army and marching on the Confederation Congress. They didn't do it by fiat. They didn't do it by force. They submitted it to ratifying conventions in every state. And in that sense, they were true to the constitutionalism and to the republican principles that they had fought for in the American Revolution.
Americans are sometimes thought of as an optimistic, hopeful people. But the writers of the Constitution certainly weren't. It comes across very strongly in your book. These guys think humans are corruptible, evil. They didn't trust the people generally. They didn't even trust each other.
That's absolutely true. One of the ironies is that they're so obsessed with power and the way in which power corrupts everyone and the way in which there are so many avenues for corruption, bribery, threats, cabals. And who are they really talking about? They're talking about one another, oddly, because they are going to be the men who lead both the state governments and the national government. And Cecilia Kenyon once wrote a wonderful article called Men of Little Faith, and she was talking about the people who opposed the Constitution. But with all due respect, if you read Madison's notes, you can't get away from the fact that the founders were also men of little faith, and that what they're trying to do is give power and then restrain it at every step of the way. They're faced with a terrible problem that they want to create a powerful, effective government, but they want to create hundreds of safeguards that protects them from the abuse of that power. And that's really the underlying theme of the convention. How do we give power, and then how do we control it?
One of the places where they focus their concern is on whether or not they should have a single executive, a president. Edmund Randolph of Virginia calls a single executive, these are his words, the fetus of monarchy.
Right.
And
yes.
You summarize other delegates who have basically the same view. An executive can do serious damage to the nation. An ambitious president can undermine the will of Congress, etc., etc. Given such concerns, how do we end up with a president at all?
Well, it's interesting. They did want to separate the executive branch from the legislative branch. They thought that this would be more efficient. They had certainly learned from the Confederation government that without an executive branch, things did not get done. So they wanted to do that, but they didn't know how they wanted that branch constituted. Some people said it should be three men, one from New England, one from the Middle States, and one from the South. Some said it should be a committee from the legislature that rotated, membership rotated. They were extremely concerned about a single person. What weakened that concern was that everyone in the room looked directly at George Washington and said, this will be the person who is the president. And so that eased some fears. What really turns the tide, ironically, they start talking about the presidency first and they realize they can't make any decisions till they solve their real issue, which is the nature of the legislature. And when they resolve that, they come back to the presidency. And what they have compromised is that the Senate will represent the states. That is, Madison, Hamilton, the real nationalists wanted a legislature that was based entirely on proportional representation because this would diminish the power of the states. This would not give them a branch of government that belonged to them. When they lose that fight, they now want to make the executive a branch of government that symbolically represents the whole nation, not the states. And so they hit upon the idea of a single individual whose office is symbolic, more than powerful, but symbolic of national unity. And this is why men like Madison begin to push for some form of popular election of the president. I don't think he would have pushed for this before he lost the battle to make the Senate representational instead of a body that represented the states.
You mentioned Madison's desire to have the president elected directly. It's a reminder that while most of the parts of the original Constitution obviously continue, some have been changed. We no longer elect U.S. senators the way the men of 1787 wanted them elected by state legislatures. And yet the Electoral College remains as the way we elect a president. How did that come to exist in the first place?
You know, I've been asked this on CNN and by talk show radio hosts during the Gore-Bush disputed election. And it's really so interesting. I think the overwhelming number of people in America believe, as one CNN fellow asked me, did they create the Electoral College to make sure the president would visit Wyoming? I was just overwhelmed by, I'm rarely speechless, and I couldn't come up with an answer to that. The Electoral College really arises out of the realities of the 18th century, when transportation and communication were really very different from today. And the assumption was, and it was accurate, that if you had a popular election, people in Georgia would vote for someone they knew, and people in Virginia would vote for someone they knew. Strange as it may seem to most people, Thomas Jefferson was not a household word in New Hampshire. People in Georgia had never heard of John Adams. There were only two people everybody had ever heard of, and that was Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. So the assumption was that you would have 600 candidates for the presidency. No one was going to get on a horse and ride from Maine to Georgia to campaign. And so the kinds of possibilities we have today didn't exist. And the Electoral College is designed with this assumption that the state legislatures would pick men to be in the Electoral College who had served in government and so consequently knew people from other states. And then they could say, oh, well, I know John Adams. He's a terrific fellow, and I'll cast my vote for him. This was a practical solution to the fact that people didn't know one another if they came from different states. Today, it does not serve that purpose, obviously. Today, when you can have a national debate between the two candidates that can be seen by everyone in America, and today when you can give a talk in New York and then fly to California and give a talk, today, really, the Electoral College is outmoded in terms of its original intent. Now, whether it ought to still exist is a very controversial question. I come down, though as a historian, my view is no more valuable about current events than anyone else's, But I come down on the side of amending the Electoral College and going directly to a popular vote, because the conditions are so totally different than they were in 1787.
There are all sorts of issues that engaged the delegates in 1787, whether large or small states should get certain kinds of representation, whether a president mm-hmm. should be one or three people. One issue that interestingly didn't seem to engage them all that much was the moral question of slavery. And I wonder, how did they avoid talking about that or being riven apart by it?
If you read the tone of the convention, I say in A Brilliant Solution, the impression that comes across very clearly is that this is not a scene in which you're going to get great oratory, in which you're going to debate philosophical questions, in which you're going to raise moral questions. This is more a kind of roll-up-your-sleeves working committee activity. They really think that the nation is in crisis, and they really think that the issue at hand is whether you can create a strong enough central government to pay its taxes, to deal with foreign countries, to protect its borders. And so they stick really closely to those, what they would consider to be prime issues. They don't even raise a lot of issues that open up, one might say, a can of social worms. And I think that these were issues that would be divisive, that would take an enormous amount of discussion. They're very practical at the convention. We can condemn them for this. I mean, we can say they ought to have discussed this. But I think that had they spent a lot of time on this, we would probably all be speaking French or have the British flag still flying over the country, or we would be in the midst of a perpetual conflict between different regions of what was once the United States. That's what they felt they were fighting to save the country. And when they do raise the issue of slavery, when Gouverneur Morris and George Mason want to raise it and have it discussed, the delegates say, not now, not now, that's not what we're here for. And so I think that they avoided it because they thought they had something else on their plate that they had to handle.
The Constitution, as we've talked about, was written behind closed doors and windows. How was it received when it finally saw the light of day and the rest of the country found out what the delegates had been doing?
One of the most interesting things is that these men did keep it secret. Here are a group of guys who love to talk, and they swear that they're not going to talk about it in public, and they hold to it, and this is really quite remarkable. James Madison, for instance, you can just tell in his letters to his father and his letters to Thomas Jefferson that he is bursting at the seams. He wants to blab what's happening, and he doesn't. But people are discussing what they think the Constitutional Convention is doing. No one is really very surprised, I don't think, when they come up with a document that says the central government will have the power to tax. So I think the general outlines of the solutions that they're coming up with would probably be not much of a surprise to politically astute or politically active people. But when they do come out with the Constitution, there is an immediate opposition that develops. The anti-federalists develop rather quickly in opposing the creation of a much stronger central government. So it's safe to say that if people were not surprised, they were very quickly polarized over whether to adopt this constitution or not. Patrick Henry, you know, has the wonderful statement. He says, "I smell a rat," which suggests that everyone understood that what this convention was going to do was create a much stronger central government.
Well, Professor Birkin, thanks so much for visiting with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me.
I've been speaking with Carol Birkin, the author of A Brilliant Solution, Inventing the American Constitution.
Thank you.
You'd not be surprised to hear that one of the best collections of historical documents on the U.S. Constitution is at the Library of Congress. But Fiona Beattie is here to tell you exactly where to look and what you'll find when you get there.
The Law Library of Congress has exhaustive online links and resources for those interested in finding out more about the Constitution of the United States. For teachers and students, there's the user-friendly Ben's Guide to the U.S. Government for Kids, and yes, that is Ben Franklin. The guide has grade-specific topics and activities with bright primary colours designed to appeal to younger users. For college students and scholars, a good place to start is the link to the Avalon Project at Yale Law School, where, among other things, you can read the Articles of Confederation and the Federalist Papers. Madison's daily reports of the Federal Convention of 1787 are available by clicking on the relevant date on the calendar. You can access journals, resolutions, proclamations, and treaties relating to the work of the Continental Congress from 1774 to 1788 by clicking on the Continental Broadside Collection, broadsides being the term for a single large sheet of paper, and there's a plethora of links, guides, and explanations of the Constitution divided into areas of interest, texts, commentaries, historical texts, and judicial decisions. To learn more about the Constitution, follow the link to the Making of the U.S. Constitution and the transcription of the introduction and first volume of the Annals of Congress. This has a brief introduction to the history of the making of the U.S. Constitution, written specifically for publication in 1834. To find out for yourself, go to www.loc.gov/law, search word Constitution.
And finally, ever since the presidential election of 2000, the news has been filled with stories of election irregularities, to perhaps understate the case. The impression we're given is that this is a new phenomenon in the United States. Not so, reports our guest commentator. Tracy Campbell is a professor of history at the University of Kentucky.
The 2004 election is over for most people, yet for some, numerous irregularities in Ohio and Washington state continue to produce alarm over the ways voting is actually conducted. This is a direct result, of course, of the 2000 election, when the term pregnant Chad unfortunately became part of our daily lives. Until then, most Americans assumed voting was a fairly straightforward and objective process. What we have since learned is that our elections are not as sacred as we had thought. This should not have been a surprise. In fact, Americans have never been confident their votes would be counted accurately. Throughout our history, vote buying, ballot box stuffing, voter suppression and intimidation, outright thievery, and sometimes even murder have been a certain component of our political culture, and voters have had to rely on little more than blind faith in hoping their votes would be accurately counted. From races from county coroner to president of the United States, a culture that has promoted cheating has long been there under the surface. In the 1880s, one observer in New York City found that over 20% of the vote in one precinct was purchased, with prices ranging from $2 to $5. What struck this observer was the casual nature of the vote-buying process. He said men of the strictest integrity, who would scorn a dishonorable action in any business or social matter, do not hesitate to take an active part in open bribery, and they do not even lose caste in the community by so doing. Their action is considered a necessary part of practical politics. Perhaps no one said it better than GOP Chairman Matt Quay, who in 1888 made the infamous remark that Benjamin Harrison never knew how close a number of men were compelled to approach the gates of the penitentiary to make him president. What to do about it? Reformers have often seen technology as the proper remedy to restore trust in elections. In 1888, reformers turned to the Australian ballot to make American elections freer and fairer. With a uniform ballot printed by the states and voters casting their choice in secret, the new ballot promised to end the vote-buying and intimidation that had marked so many elections. In 1892, another major reform occurred when the first mechanical voting machines were patented. The New York Times even hailed it as a perfected voting machine, a device for registering voters, quote, without possibility of fraud. The 20th century displayed that such machines and headlines were hardly perfect. The 2000 contest has often been compared to 1960. Although we are familiar with Richard Daley's role in delivering John F. Kennedy enough votes to win Illinois in 1960, another disputed state in that contest was Texas. After a Republican attempt to recount thousands of spoiled ballots was rejected, the state attorney general said it best. Quote, I have found that elections are like cement. When they are set, they harden, and that's it. So election fraud has managed to survive, and creative partisans have quickly adapted to new methods. They understand what so many voters have now seen firsthand, that the ways in which political capital has been earned in the United States sometimes has little to do with fairly measuring the consent of the governed.
You've been listening to Tracy Campbell, professor of history at the University of Kentucky. Campbell is completing a book on the history of American election fraud that will be published later this year by Carroll and Graff. That's it for another week of Talking History. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just send them to us either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. For more information on Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.